story behind the headlines. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, again presents Cesar Searchinger, noted foreign correspondent and writer, in an informal analysis of the news. Nothing that happens is without its relation to the past. Somewhere in history are recorded the forerunners of the events which overshadow our lives today. With the assistance of a research panel of eminent historians, Mr. Searchinger retraces the events of the past to help you in arriving at a fuller understanding of what is happening today. Copies of these talks may be obtained through the Columbia University Press. Simply send 10 cents in coin or stamps to the Columbia University Press or the National Broadcasting Company, New York City. Mr. Searchinger's subject tonight is the war in Greece.
Good evening, everybody. This is the 13th day of Italy's war against Greece. According to fascist estimates, it was to have taken 2 or 3 weeks to win this war. Today, after more than half of that time, the Italians are nowhere more than a few miles inside Greek territory. And at one point, the Greeks have actually pushed beyond their own frontier. At last accounts, they were stoutly resisting the Italian drive into Epirus, where, by the way, the great poet Homer located hell. And their tough mountain troops, the kilted Evzones, may be expected to defend every inch of the passes that lead across the Pindus Mountains into the plain of Thessaly. Of course, it would be wrong to be too optimistic about the Greeks' ability to resist the Italians for long. The Italians have at least 250,000 on the Greek front, a strong mechanized force and airplanes galore. The Greeks have barely 150,000 men under arms altogether, and their air force is very small. Moreover, the Italians have just started their real offensive now that it is clear that the Greeks won't capitulate, won't coordinate themselves with the Axis new order in the Balkans and the Near East. But the very fact that the Greeks, weakest of the Balkan peoples, have alone taken up the challenge is a measure of their courage and their stamina. It is also an indication of their faith in the effectiveness of British support, in which sea power is the important factor. There is a historical reason for their belief. When this war broke out, crowds in Athens marched to the British legation, waving Greek flags and the Union Jack. They were, of course, thinking of Britain's pledge to come to their aid. But some certainly were also thinking of their country's revolutionary war over a century ago. Then, too, they were the only Balkan people to rise successfully against a superior power. Then, too, support came from the great seafaring nation in the West. Here is the situation as it was 120 years ago. For centuries, ever since the Turkish inundation of the Balkans, there had been no independent Greece. The ancient Greeks, the people of ancient Hellas, whose bright and gleaming spirit had kindled the lights of civilization all over the Western world, the race of Homer and Aristotle and Sophocles had disappeared. The glory that was Greece had vanished as completely as the grandeur that was Rome. The Greek city-states had been destroyed after the Romans burned Corinth. Athenian culture was wiped out by centuries of violence and decay. The whole country was degraded by oppression and partly depopulated by poverty under 4 centuries of Turkish rule. But the memory of the golden age of Hellas was not dead. Thanks to the scholars and educators of the West, the Greek tradition of learning and the worship of truth and beauty had become a living force. And Greece itself had become a mecca for poets and artists who mourned its fate. Fair Greece, sang Byron, sad relic of departed worth, immortal though no more, though fallen great. And it was the force of this tradition, living still in the ruins of the Parthenon and the lovely Greek statues in our museums, that roused the sympathies of the entire world to the support of Greece, and so gave the Greek Revolution a unique appeal. The revolt was launched in southern Greece by the Archbishop Germanos, who raised the Christian cross as a revolutionary symbol in 1821. At once the idea of a reborn Greece, inspired by French revolutionary ideals, enlisted the intellectual hotheads of the time. The Greeks fought bravely in their mountains and on the sea, and for a time they seemed to be winning out. They had one great advantage over the Turks, in that they were a seafaring people by nature. In fact, the Turks had always depended on their Greek subjects to man the Turkish fleet. So now the Sultan had to call on the Egyptian fleet to help him out and restore his mastery on the sea. And pretty soon the tide turned against the rebels, who incidentally were also fighting against each other. The Greeks would have lost their fight for independence altogether if they had not secured outside aid. And here is where England comes in. Among those intellectual hotheads I just mentioned was Lord Byron, the great English poet, then about 36 years old, and, as it happened, very rich. Byron had always had an incurable itch to play a great role as a statesman or soldier, and he was inclined to blame his lame leg for having condemned him to fight only with his pen. Some other English enthusiasts finally induced him to fit out a ship, sail to Greece, and organize a new center of resistance with the help of English technicians, modern weapons, and ammunition. That episode is the most fantastic, even in Byron's fantastic life, and it ended after 3 months with the poet's death from malarial fever in what one of his companions called the land of fleas, flies, and thieves. But Byron didn't die in vain. The prestige of his name did much to rally the liberals of Europe to the aid of the Greeks. It brought about the collaboration of England with Russia and France, which resulted in the destruction of the Turkish fleet in Navarino Bay. That was in 1827, 2.5 years after Byron's death. And 2.5 years after that, the independence of Greece was recognized. A Bavarian prince was placed on the throne in 1932 with the title of King of the Hellenes. Greece was the first country to emerge from the Turkish inundation, a poverty-stricken nation of 651,000 people, not much over 500,000. It has about 7 million today. Now, although Greek independence was largely due to the intervention of a Russian army in the north and a French one in the south, the Greeks are grateful mainly to England, symbolized in the person of her romantic poet, Byron. And England has been able to capitalize on that gratitude ever since by taking Greece under her tutelage and helping her to grow relatively strong. Greece was given the Ionian Islands, hitherto British, including Corfu in 1864. She was allowed to take Thessaly from the Turks, and after the Balkan Wars, her boundaries included Salonika and the island of Crete. No wonder that Britain expected cooperation from Greece in the World War of 1914. But this is what happened in the World War. The king of Greece, Constantine, nicknamed Tino, was the Kaiser's brother-in-law. And he was suspected of being pro-German, though his liberal premier, Venizelos, was definitely pro-ally. Venizelos invited the Allies to land 150,000 troops in Saloniki, whereupon he had to resign. But the Allies landed troops all the same. Only there were too few, so few that they were condemned to inactivity. The Romanians expected these troops under the French general Sarai to attack the Kaiser's Bulgarian allies, but they didn't. So the Romanian soldiers marched alone to the chant of O Sarai, 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 noi ne batem si tu stai, which means, O Sarai, we are fighting while you stand still. So nothing happened, except that the Allies shelled Athens and later forced the king to abdicate, while Venizelos brought Greece into the war. King Tino, by the way, was succeeded by his son Alexander, but shortly after the war he returned, his son having died as the result of a monkey bite. Tragedy caught up with the whole Greek people a year or so later, as the result of a disastrous war with Turkey. In the peace treaties, the Greeks had been given Smyrna in Asia Minor as a reward for coming into the war. But the Turks, under their dynamic leader Mustafa Kemal, undertook to dispossess them. The Greeks, left unsupported by the Allies, were driven out of Asia, their army was massacred, and Smyrna burned. Hundreds of thousands of Greek residents had to flee for their lives. Then, under the terms of a new peace treaty, Over 1 million Turkish Greeks were repatriated to Greece. This was the first of these famous population exchanges and the most cruel. Imagine, more than 1 million refugees to take care of all at once for a little country like Greece. King Tino, by the way, took the rap again, and in 1922 he abdicated a second time in favor of his son George this time. George, too, was forced to abdicate after a reign of 15 months. And in 1924, on the 103rd anniversary of Greek independence, the people voted for a republic. But the republic gave way to a dictatorship, and the dictatorship to a royal restoration. So, in 1935, King George II ended his pleasant English exile to become king a second time. If Greece is pro-British today, it is partly due to George, but partly also to the old memory of Britain's championship of Greek independence over a century ago. You can still find peasants in Greece today who speak of Lordos Byron with reverent awe. Greece, it is true, is a dictatorship again today. So it is not a case of a democracy fighting against a totalitarian foe. Moreover, the Greek dictator John Metaxas was pro-German until a little while ago, just as his one-time master, King Tino, was in 1915. But even dictator Metaxas cannot risk appeasing Italy when Italy is challenging British supremacy in the Mediterranean Sea. So long as Britain controls the eastern Mediterranean, Greek independence is safe. If that control should pass to Italy, if the Mediterranean should once again become a Roman sea, then modern Greece would go the way of her ancestor, ancient Hellas, when it fell under the Caesar's heel. So, once again, Greek soldiers in their mountain passes face the legions of Italy to defend the independence of their country. And the British Navy is doing its part in defending her own lifeline as well as the life of Greece. British warships are protecting the Greek islands, and British planes are bombing Italian centers of supply. But no British army has yet landed in Saloniki to stem the Italian eastward advance. With the present British forces available in the east, such a move might weaken the British position in Egypt, where another Italian army is driving east. That might be just what Mussolini wants, for, so we are given to understand, the drive through Egypt and the drive through Greece are parts of a great pincers movement which is to threaten the Suez Canal and the oil fields of the Near East. If that is so, those Greek soldiers facing the Italians in Epirus are performing a function that may turn out to be historic. 2,420 years ago, the Spartan king Leonidas held the pass of Thermopylae with 7,000 men against an overwhelming force of Persians, until he was betrayed and the Persians swept down to Athens and burned the Acropolis. But even while Leonidas was holding the pass, the Athenian fleet was preparing to give battle, and eventually the Persians were forced to retreat and evacuate most of Greece. Today, all Greece is a Thermopylae, stemming the tide of totalitarian advance, but the decision is pending elsewhere, on the waters of the Mediterranean and in the British sky. Good night.
You have been listening to Caesar Searchinger. Please remember that copies of these talks are available for 10 cents in stamps or coin by addressing the Columbia University Press, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. Next Friday evening, Caesar Searchinger will be back with another story behind the headlines. This program has been presented as a public service by the National Broadcasting Company and the independent radio stations associated with the NBC networks.